Hello and welcome to the Post-Capitalism Podcast. I'm Chris Wellard. In this episode, we'll be talking about how capitalism shapes our conception of disability, its impact on our mental health, and how we can rethink the welfare state. My guest is David Matthews, a lecturer in sociology and social policy at Coleg Llanelwchso, Wales, and a leader of its degree programme in health and social care. We'll discuss how capitalism co-opts progressive politics, the monotony of work, and why it's okay to enjoy watching wrestling. I'll also be waiting to discover if I've deservedly been cancelled by Welsh language Twitter. We hope you enjoy the episode. So, David, I'd like to start by talking about the welfare state, which feels like an inherently progressive thing, but in your work you've suggested it's actually often used as a tool by both the left and the right to pursue their own ends. Could you break that idea down for us a bit?
Well, we often think of the welfare state, as being something which we, first off, in the post-war era anyway, we tend to associate it with being perhaps part of the social democratic consensus, especially in Britain. And so inherently, we might consider it as being sort of more left in nature and being there for the working classes and something which was there to support the working classes and the labour force. And that aspect of things and that aspect of the argument is without doubt true to a certain degree in terms of it having beneficial qualities for the working class and for the labour force during the post-war era in the advanced capitalist world and today as well. But we need to see the welfare state as actually being what it really is, and it's a product of capitalism, and we need to see it as being essentially a product of class conflict within capitalism. So it's very much a struggle, a phenomenon which arises from struggle. And we can see embedded within it class forces and class struggle. Traditionally, Marxist theorists of the welfare state have tended to view it as being primarily a capitalist institution. And you know, in the 1970s, when Marxist theorizing of the welfare state in many ways was at its peak, was at its height, you had individuals in the United States, for example, like James O'Connor, and you had individuals in Britain like Ian Gough, who would argue essentially, and others would argue essentially, that of the functions that the welfare state had for capitalism then. And while they are right as well in many ways, again, that's perhaps too one-sided and too deterministic. So we need to see the welfare state as primarily a dialectical phenomenon. So using the Marxist terminology, we need to see the welfare state as being a dialectical phenomenon, one which arises, as I said, from class struggle between labour, between capital. And we want to see the welfare state as actually being a platform upon which class struggle is fought. I mean, the welfare state is inherently part of the state itself. And yes, the state under capitalism is essentially a capitalist state. But that does not mean that there isn't room there for labour to make its mark and for the working class to have an input in relation to the welfare state and to use the welfare state as a means to advance its cause and to oppose exploitation and oppression, as history illustrates that this is the case. So I think where you have Marxist theorists who correctly identify that the welfare state has important functions for capitalism in terms of, say, producing a labour force which is productive, both physically and in terms of sort of educational knowledge, just as an example, that kind of ignores the history behind the welfare state in many advanced capitalist nations. And it kind of ignores the fact that labour had a strong role to play in the development of the welfare state as well. Now, historically, it might be the case that when labour and the working classes pushed for the welfare state, it might very well have been the case that they weren't necessarily advocating for socialism in this process. It may very well have been the case that in some cases, they were advocating for essentially reforms within a capitalist context when it came to introducing and it came to implementing the welfare state. But that shouldn't take anything away from the input that the working class have had historically when it comes to the welfare state. I think we can find the basis for this in some of the works of Marx and Engels themselves when it comes to Marx and Engels' interpretation of factory legislation in the 1800s in Britain. Marx and Engels discuss factory legislation very much within the context of being the product of class conflict, and they very much identify how factory legislation was something agitated for by the working classes and something how initially it was opposed by capital. But then we see very much capital accepting factory legislation because they actually then see factory legislation as being beneficial for themselves. So factory legislation can be seen, if you like, as an example of social policy and the relationship that the working classes and capital have had towards welfare and social policy as well.
You just talked about factory legislation, and with apologies for dragging us back in time a bit here, I was wondering if you could provide some more details about that, as I think it's increasingly relevant at a time when we're seeing gig workers, like people who work for Uber or do hard miles for food delivery apps, are witnessing a fresh fight for workers' rights.
Well, I mean, primarily back in the mid-1800s, we're talking about the length of the working day, and we're talking about how from the perspective of capital, from the perspective of bourgeoisie, there was an effort, if you like, to wring the working classes of every ounce and drop of productivity that they had. And so you may be having 13, 14, 15 hour days. But conversely, this was having a significant impact upon the physical nature of the working classes, and also the mental health of the working classes as well. So you've got then labour are in opposition to this. Labour are actually trying to oppose this because of the impact, if we're using sort of modern day language, the impact it's having upon their well-being and upon their own sort of reproduction. So in many ways, Labour's agitation for factory legislation in this period was actually very much about them protecting their reproduction on an everyday basis in terms of being physically fit to be able to go back to work. So from Labour's perspective, factory legislation was important in order to protect themselves, to protect their physicality, to protect their mental health and therefore their well-being in order to ensure that they could sort of reproduce themselves on an everyday basis. In a way, it was kind of like factory legislation to a certain degree was about labour having control over their own reproduction up to a point. Whereas from the perspective of capital, that effort or that attempt to control the working day was seen as essentially a barrier really to the production of, well, absolute surplus value, as Marx referred to it. So you get this process involved there. So you get this dynamic emerging, this conflict emerging there. But at the same time, it's worth noting how, from Marx's perspective, factory legislation could be viewed up to a point as being a victory for socialism and a victory of the working classes. Because here, for the first time, we're seeing the state intervene, really, or the state intervene on a significant scale to try and regulate the economy.
For all the differences, I suppose it feels like employment is becoming more precarious and more dominated by companies like it was in the past. And I'm speculating here, but it feels like capitalists often use the welfare state as a means to get away with destructive or corrosive policies, as they can still point to a safety net as almost offsetting any damage that's done.
I mean, certainly you could argue this phrase, if you like, the sort of welfare state has been a safety net, which I think many of us could argue it is not. But I think that has very much entered popular discourse and popular understanding of the welfare state there. And I think you're right in terms of that the right could protect, can engage in practices which then in turn may be seen as mitigating or having an impact upon working classes. But yes, they can actually then point to the welfare state there as being something which justifies that action and can be seen almost, I suppose you could say, that the existence of the welfare state is part of the ideal, from the right perspective, part of the ideological tool to justify capitalism, to justify exploitation and oppression. But say, look, you know, this might happen to you and you may have to engage in these practices when you're in work, and you may have to risk yourself when you're at work and have very little input and democracy and democratic input in work. However, should things go wrong, etc., there's this that you can fall back on. But with the ideological sort of understanding and an attempt to promote the idea that actually that is there for the benefit of working people, but in many ways what they benefit from that is very little.
I'd like to focus on a couple of areas now that triangulate the relationship between the welfare state, capitalism, and us as individuals. One subject you've written a lot about is the idea of how capitalism shapes our perceptions of disability in ways that are oppressive and discriminatory. Can you tell us how that works in practice?
When we talk about disability in particular, we need to make the distinction between impairment and disability. And we need to see impairment as being the physical or biological issue, whereas disability should be seen as being essentially a social status, which is more often than not conferred on people who have an impairment of one form or another. Now, we live in a culture, we live in a society where impairment and disability are frequently seen as being one and used interchangeably. Now, for the last 40 odd years in Britain and America and other countries, we've had the social model of disability. Now, the social model of disability was an effort to try and demonstrate that actually there's a difference between impairment and disability. Originally, the social model of disability was an attempt to argue that disability was this status, if you like, which was conferred upon people. And it was a status, one of oppression, one of exploitation, one of marginalization. So disability was seen as being a status of marginalization and oppression that was conferred upon people as a result of their impairments and the way capitalist society treated individuals with impairments. Now, when it comes to that, really what we want to see, disability is something which arises. Now, if we're looking at it from a Marxist perspective in particular, we want to see disability as something which arises from really the incompatibility between the physicality of an individual on the one hand and the productive nature and needs of the economy on the other hand. So while I've written about this, and while Marx and Engels in their works, they certainly refer to impairment. So the issue of impairment is certainly something which is sporadically found within their works, especially within the works of Engels when he wrote The Condition of the Working Class in England, where he looked at the detrimental nature of capitalism upon working class life. So Marx and Engels certainly identified impairment as an issue, but they didn't really talk about disability. However, you can find a theory, if you like, of disability, or a Marxist theory of disability within their works. And like I say, the foundation of a Marxist theory of disability is one which is very much about this incompatibility between the impairment on the one hand, the physicality of the body on the one hand, and the productive needs of the economy on the other. Because Marx recognized the important role of the body when it came to productivity. Marx was acutely aware of the relationship between production and the role of the body in the productive process. Marx argued in Capital that production required the exertion of the body. It required the exertion of the mind, for example. And Marx and Engels were aware and argued that in many ways, certainly in the capitalism of their era, that the body could be seen as an appendage to productive machinery. So Marx and Engels, while they don't explicitly talk about it, can find within their work this idea that they develop a conception of the body, like a normalization of the body. And from Marx and Engels' perspective, the normal body, if you want to use that term, is the body which can keep up with the productivity of machinery or factory life. Now, what Marx argued as well is that, in actual fact, in most cases, the productivity of machinery could outpace that of the normal body, if you want to put it that way. So Marx identified that the non-impaired body could often find it difficult to keep up with the productive pace of machinery. So what Marx and Engels identify really within their work is actually what you might call an economically valuable or an economically productive body, because impairment or disability, I should say, arises really from a Marxist perspective from individuals having what might not be deemed as a productive body. So they're deemed as not having an economically productive body because their body is not seen as really having this compatibility with the productive nature of capitalism there. So we find within their works a conception of the normal body, which is a body which should be able to keep up with productivity, even though Marx and Engels do recognize that even the normal body has trouble keeping up with the productive nature of machinery. But in particular, those bodies which are unable to keep up with the productive nature of capitalism, they are often defined as having sort of economic, sort of less worth economically.
If we look at the modern welfare state, does that definition of disability remain in place, or have things moved on a little bit from there?
In a number of ways, yes. If we look at social policy in relation to disability, then arguably the role of work as a means to define disability does feature quite prominently in various social policies. And I'm thinking about Britain, and the last decade has been one of austerity and has been one of various sort of welfare reforms, using again that term loosely there, reform. And disability policies have been at top of the agenda, essentially, over the last 10 years. And we've seen in Britain the implementation of Employment Support Allowance, ESA. And that's been one of the sort of key sort of changes in relation to social policy in Britain when it comes to disability. And ESA is very much an income-based policy. It's very much a disability policy which is there to try and replace the income that disabled individuals might have achieved or might have got if they were in work. And ESA has embedded within it a very controversial work capability assessment, which is used really to define whether individuals are in a position to work. And what we see with ESA and the work capability assessment is very much the welfare state's role in trying to define disability based upon ability to work. And very broadly, the work capability assessment, when it's applied to individuals with disabilities, there's broadly, if you like, three options which can emerge from that assessment. It's one option is that an individual is not defined as having a disability, and therefore they are considered fit to work. You've got the second option, which is an individual might be seen as having a disability, but they still have some capability of working. And then they are then encouraged to engage in perhaps work-related activities, where it be voluntary work or training. Or you get the third group of people, which are those who are defined as not having the ability to work, because their impairment is seen as such that they generally cannot engage productively with the labour force. So you've got ESA as a core disability social policy, which has emerged in Britain over the last decade. And it's very much about defining whether somebody is considered disabled or not, based upon labour, based upon productivity and engaging in the labour market.
Could you maybe quantify some of the outcomes regarding how people with disabilities are left at a disadvantage as a result of the current mindset and its practical application?
I mean, the evidence is purely in relation to individuals who have disabilities. So coming back to this issue of it, you know, making a difference between impairment and disability. But the evidence is only in relation to individuals with disabilities who are classed as having disabilities. We do see them very much disadvantaged in the labour market. On average in Britain, and this is broadly similar in many other advanced capitalist countries, we see people with disabilities who have an employment rate of twice that of people who are considered able-bodied. We see roughly in Britain today, the employment rate for people who are classed as disabled is around about 50% compared to 75 to 80% of people who are considered able-bodied. We do see roughly around about a 20% pay gap per hour for people with disabilities compared to able-bodied individuals. So people with disabilities on average earn 20% less an hour than people who are considered able-bodied. And just purely at the same time, we do see people who are classed as disabled as actually working in sort of very precarious conditions in terms of often it's temporary work, seasonal work, and very much so when redundancies need to be made, may find themselves the first to go. So people who are classed as disabled are very much in a precarious nature when it comes to the labour market, and a very unstable characterisation of the labour market is a feature of their experience.
This is a pretty huge question, but do you think we can move beyond disability at the conceptual level as we understand it today, as it's pretty entrenched in the dialogue?
I mean, it's just an interesting question. And in terms of, would we ever be in a position as a society or as a culture to completely eradicate the concept of disability? I suspect not to a point in terms of, well, okay, so I suppose it does depend on how you define that. Again, it's coming back to the issue of impairment and disability. Now, would we ever eradicate impairment? No. Highly unlikely that we would ever eradicate the issue of impairment. But if we consider disability as being purely a social construct, and very much social construct which originates from the material nature of society in terms of the productive process, and if we very much suggest that actually, well, how about thinking again about how the labour force is managed, how our workplaces are managed to be inclusive of people with impairments, then very much so we could argue that actually we could get rid of disability as a concept entirely. If we see disability as really being a concept which is one based upon really marginalisation and oppression of individuals with impairments from the labour market. So to answer your question there, then I think we could actually get rid of it entirely in an alternative economic system. But would we ever get rid of impairment? Then no. And in that case, then clearly support and sufficient support should be provided for those individuals with impairments who are unable to engage in productive activity of whatever nature that is.
You've also argued that the professionalisation of disability politics has impacted grassroots efforts and watered down the original radical ambitions of the movement. Could you talk us through that idea a bit?
The disability movement, over the last two decades, in Britain and in the United States, particularly in Britain, however, has been one which has evolved from being this grassroots radical movement to perhaps being one more of a corporate type of movement in some respects. I mean, the disability movement in Britain in the 1970s began with the import of socialism and socialists. It was very much a socialist movement in the broad sense of the term. And it's from that which the social model emerged. I mean, the social model of disability emerged from the disability rights movement in the 1970s as a way of trying to draw people's attention to the fact that society and capitalist society needed to change in order for people with impairments to feel included within society. But as we got into the 1990s, we see the movement change in two sort of broad ways, really. One way it changed was the fact that the social model was embraced more by the mainstream. So by the 1990s, you're having politicians, you're having governments accepting the social model of disability, which in many ways is a good thing. And it was a good thing and it still is. But it's what aspect of it they accepted and the interpretation of the social model, which was an issue. The interpretation of the social model by the 1990s, by sort of more mainstream disability movements and charities and governments, was one very much where the disability rights spin was put upon it. And the argument was essentially, well, people with disabilities can be included in society if they just have more rights. If legislation was seen as being the goal, really, to try and include people with disabilities in society. So equal opportunities, for example. But at the time, as doing that, they ignored the more radical aspects of the social model, which was actually looking at structure and operation and organisation of societies themselves and of capitalist society. So that aspect of the social model was pushed to one side. And you then get this focus, as I say, upon more law, legal issues, that's as being the way in which people with disabilities can be included in society. This then, by the late 1990s and into the early 2000s, emerges with and develops with a relationship with the disability rights movement, sort of more mainstream aspect of it, and neoliberalism. Some of the, perhaps, if you want to say, it's the more sort of soft side of neoliberalism, or the socially respectable and acceptable side of neoliberalism, is then something which the mainstream of the disability movement is accepting there. We're talking about issues, for example, of independent living. So the independent living movement as a part of the disability rights movement, which was, it remains and was a crucial aspect of it, was actually co-opted by and embraced by individuals who were more sympathetic to neoliberalism and, if you like, twisted to a point in terms of, so the independent living movement of the disability rights movement was then twisted in terms of coming under the principle of individualism within neoliberalism as well. And so neoliberalism and neoliberal principles were then incorporated into the disability rights movement, and issues of individualism and self-sufficiency, which are key parts of neoliberalism, and a focus upon the self, then became part of the mainstream of the disability rights movement, and especially, as I say, the independent living movement. So those ideals were put together there. And so then you've got mainstream governments, mainstream charities then accept that sort of version of the disability rights movement there.
It strikes me again, like when we were talking about the welfare state, that there's a certain co-opting of progressive thinking to absorb it into capitalism and so protect the existing system's interests.
No, I think you're right in terms of, I think to a certain degree, in terms of you're looking at, as you say, sort of incorporating the disability rights movement within sort of the wider welfare state, or the acceptable aspects of the welfare state is then very much sort of incorporating individuals with disabilities into a neoliberal project. And it's very much sort of the hegemonic side of the welfare state there, in terms of, again, demonstrating that actually, or ideologically trying to demonstrate that the welfare state has many benefits and positives for individuals with disabilities, and trying to co-opt them into it, as you say. Yeah.
Another side of this for me is that capitalism has a homogenizing effect that flattens our experience by reducing us to producers and consumers. And by not valuing the inputs of people with impairments, who've got very different life experiences and so could have very different creative ideas or ways of thinking about the world, we're both oppressing them and denying them and society as a whole the benefits that we could gain from embracing their creativity, their experience, their knowledge, and so on.
I mean, you're right in terms of looking at it from the perspective of the labour process. Yes, if individuals with impairments are being denied or being denied an opportunity to engage in productive process because their bodies are therefore seen as not being able to fit the productive process or the workings and the operations of capitalism, then you're absolutely right in terms of that we as a society are denying ourselves the potential that all individuals could have and the input that they could have within society, the creative input, the intellectual input they could have, if we are just very much excluding them based upon the requirement to make profit and the process to make profit. And so for the need to have a more inclusive democratic engagement and more of a democratic society, which allows individuals of all abilities to take part and not being excluded based upon a very narrow conception of what is seen as productive and what is seen as acceptable or not, is very much to the detriment of us all in society.
I want to switch tracks a little bit now, although we're probably going to discuss a lot of related issues to what we've already been talking about. But I'd like you to go into some of the work you've done on how capitalism impacts our mental health. Could you give us a summary of your perspective here?
I mean, on the one hand, we certainly see evidence to suggest, this is evidence which goes back decades now, that there's a strong relationship between class and mental health. And that we see that there's a strong relationship between, on the whole, people from more working class backgrounds suffering greater mental health problems. At the same time, the evidence suggests that people with mental health problems who are from and remain in lower class positions find it more difficult to develop or to find it more difficult in terms of sort of emerging from their mental health problem in a positive sense. So, and there's been quite a bit of research done over the years on schizophrenia, for example, and how recovery rates for people with schizophrenia tend to be less for people from more working class, more lower class backgrounds. But interestingly, on that issue, the evidence suggests as well that recovery from schizophrenia, for example, tends to be less in periods of economic decline, economic downturns as well, whereas then you've got the opposite during periods of sort of more economic prosperity, recovery rates tend to be higher. So there's evidence which illustrates that there is this close relationship between mental health, the experience of it, and also how one deals with those issues there of mental health and the impact that capitalism can have upon mental health there and the labour market. But at the same time, so the relationship between mental health and capitalism is a very interesting one in terms of, well, from a Marxist perspective, we need to perhaps try and develop a materialist psychology and a materialist understanding of mental health. And we need to recognise when it comes to mental health in general and positive psychology in general, we need to recognise that there's a very strong, again, it comes back to this dialectical relationship, but there's a very strong relationship between the body and the environment within which an individual is in. And I think it's important, certainly from my perspective, from the perspective I've written about, to accept that if we're trying to understand positive mental health under capitalism, we have to accept, first off, that there is a sort of biological aspect to it. We can't just assume that individuals are a blank slate and that capitalism and society has all of an impact upon it. From a Marxist perspective and from the perspective that I've been writing about, we need to accept that there's this dialectical relationship between biology on the one hand and capitalism on the other, and that capitalism has this tendency to suppress and to direct our more natural needs, our more natural energies, our biotic needs, if you want to use that, or organic needs. And the way in which capitalism suppresses and directs our biotic needs, our organic needs, can have serious consequences for our mental health, both positively and negatively.
Where does work fit into this equation? For a lot of people, it's monotonous and draining mentally and physically, but it's also weirdly at the same time become associated with virtue and moral rectitude from a social perspective. And that seems to leave us in a paradoxical conundrum.
The issue of alienation is crucial here when we're talking about the relationship between work and we're talking about mental health. So going back to the sort of classic and core of Marxist concept here of alienation. But the nature of the work process has considerable ramifications for our mental health. And it's interesting in terms of how we live in a culture, we live in a society where perhaps not enjoying work is considered the norm. We tend to live in a culture where actually possibly if we come across somebody who says, yeah, I really enjoy my work, it's fun, I get a lot of fulfillment from it, we might consider them the exception. Being sort of displeased with work, being perhaps sort of having sort of mild, if you like, disgruntlements with work and general sort of unhappiness with work is actually seen as being the norm in our culture. So alienation, so feeling a sense of alienation within work and from work, that mental health condition, and I consider alienation as being a core mental health condition. Arguably, I would argue that alienation underpins many other mental health conditions which we take as for granted today. But alienation is very much a core experience within the work process. And it's something which many of us feel is part of our everyday experience of work. And features of work can be very repetitive. We're not just talking about manual factory-based sort of operations now, but many so-called middle-class operations now and organizations are very repetitive. They're very regulated. They're very target-driven. So many people are feeling alienated from what should be a creative process, because work should be that creative process. It should be that fulfilling process. It should be something that we want to do. And I think we've all felt that up to a point when, you know, we engage in something, we do something, we produce something, and we actually feel good about it because we've invested ourselves in that. We feel rewarded by it. We can see ourselves in what we've produced. But for many people, work is something which they are very much detached from because they don't see themselves in the work. They don't feel any investment. They don't feel any link to that. So work is something which in our culture has very considerable consequences for our mental health there in terms of it very much underpins arguably a lot of our sort of what we might call perhaps more sort of mild mental health issues, which many people get. So we're just talking about issues of despondency, frustration, not being happy with your life. Now, these are clearly poor mental health experiences, which many of us feel. And arguably, in many cases, they are related to work there. Because work under capitalism doesn't often allow us to be spontaneous. It doesn't allow us to be spontaneous. It doesn't allow us to engage in the creative process because of that heavy regulated nature, because of the fact that we don't feel a connection with what we're doing.
Away from work, I also wonder if the way we spend our leisure time has been impacted too. For example, sitting back and watching Netflix is still us being consumers, and also being passive and idle, and maybe just trying to forget about work until we have to get up the next day and start all over again.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one in terms of what we do for enjoyment. And I mean, I think about this myself in terms of what I do, in terms of what some of my interests. I could take the, and I believe it as well to a certain degree, that I could take perhaps the higher ground, if you like, on this one. And you can look at perhaps aspects of popular culture. You can look at what people might engage in terms of whether it be watching, you know, blockbuster films, Hollywood films, or whether it be just watching soaps or just reading perhaps a throwaway novel type of thing. And there's a very sort of persuasive argument in many ways to suggest that, well, these aren't challenging. They're not intellectually challenging. They're not stretching us, but they have a role in capitalist society because they are there to partly, as many members of the Frankfurt School argued back in the mid 20th century, there to help pacify the masses in terms of, because they don't stretch someone's sort of intellectual capabilities and sort of disposition, if you like, then it's going to prevent the masses from uprising. Or from another perspective, these are things seen as being ways to somewhat make up for the misery of our existence in terms of, you know, we've had a bad day at work, we just want to forget about it, we just want to chill out, and all we want to do is we just want to slump in front of the TV and watch Netflix or whatever it might be. So from a capitalist perspective, they have a role in terms of pacifying the masses. In some ways, we could say that they're seen as, you know, chewing gum for the mind, some aspects of popular culture there, because they don't incite critical thinking. And so they're not inciting that creativity aspect of us. And also, on the other side of things, popular culture is very much a productive process and churning out program after program and book after book, for example. So there's very much an economic, direct economic positivity there for capitalism. I find that an interesting one because while I do see that perspective, and in many ways I do agree with that in terms of that these things are seen, aspects of popular culture are seen as ways of pacifying us, and certainly in terms of the intellectual demands upon them don't require us to think critically, which therefore perhaps doesn't create that character in people to question and think critically. On the other hand, I just think from my own perspective, well, I as much as anybody enjoy these things, I enjoy watching, you know, Netflix. I mean, I'll be the first to admit that I'm the one who enjoys reading comic books and watching the wrestling. You know, I mean, I'm quite happy to admit I enjoy watching, you know, wrestling and reading graphic novels and things like that. So that's probably the core, if you like, popular culture in terms of somebody looking down upon those and thinking, well, they're not particularly intellectually rigorous, are they? So we all find enjoyment in some of these things. So I think the jury is out on that one, really, in terms of how negative that they are for you. I certainly do think that they don't necessarily stimulate critical thinking, and that has a benefit for capitalism. But on the other hand, I think losing yourself in a graphic novel, losing yourself in watching a Batman film, it's quite good recuperation as well for your mental health.
I'm looking forward to a podcast episode on wrestling and post-capitalism. The puns alone could easily fill up an hour.
Sign me up for that one.
In the meantime, I'm wondering how more direct forms of consumerism, like buying physical goods, shapes our pathology.
I mean, consumerism is very much a cultural activity. It's something that's been theorized about a lot and its role in capitalism. The link between consumerism and mental health is very much in relation to the issue of searching for identity, and how, in many ways, as has often been stated, when we purchase things, whether it be a pair of trainers or, you know, item of clothing or a car, whatever it is, we're often trying to purchase the symbolic value of it. And we're often trying to attempt to have whatever that car is supposed to say, we're hoping that some of that will rub off on us and make us that type of person, or those trainers will make us that type of person. But it's very much the search for an empty identity. And so arguably, you could say that the alienation that many people experience under capitalism, an aspect of that alienation is not having that sense of real self. It's not having found that real self. And you can say that sense of real self is something which can be often found through work and through engagement with other people, which you genuinely enjoy, and having those rich social experiences and those rich productive experiences. And so your identity can emerge from that. It's hoped. But because for many people don't have that level of engagement, then they have an empty identity and therefore are experiencing alienation. So they seek identity through consumerism, through the consumption process, in the hope that, like I say, the symbolic nature of the car, the dress, the trainers becomes you, and you adopt that. But it's very much a fleeting identity. You may feel good about yourself walking down the street for the first time when you're wearing your new trainers, but put them on for the fourth time, you're probably, you know, that sense of fulfillment has gone, and you're on to the next search for that fulfillment through consumerism again. So I think the relationship between consumerism and mental health can be found within that search for failure to have, I should say.
As we near the end of the episode, I have several massive questions for you to tackle. The first one is, how might we start shifting our mindsets, particularly when we think about mental health?
I mean, it's something I've been thinking about, and I suppose I have a collection of ideas in my mind here in terms of, I think the key is the concepts of inclusion, cooperation, cohesiveness, creating cultures, creating environments whereby people, and I hesitate to use the term because it's very much as if I'm using discourses that we're trying to argue against, but making people feel like stakeholders and part of what they're involved in, part of their communities, part of their workplaces. It's creating very much more democratic experiences and democratic organizations and institutions within which people feel that they have a sense of ownership, that they can make a difference, and that they have an opportunity to recognize that if they work with people rather than against people, then not only can collectively community and society achieve more, but they themselves as individuals will benefit far more from that interaction and from the output which is produced from the collective efforts. So it is very much, I would argue, if we're looking at how can we think ahead and try and improve our mental health, and what does a good society look like where mental health is seen or experienced more positively, then it has to be a society based upon democracy, inclusion, altruism, collectivism, these very much bringing people together to work, to help each other, and also mitigate against sort of issues of competition. So, you know, competition is really one of those particular aspects which has so much detrimental consequences for our mental health. Feeling that we are competing against people and constantly competing against people can have very much detrimental consequences for our mental health. So it will be cooperation rather than competition should be sort of key, sort of dominant moral characteristics and features of a good society when it comes to trying to promote our mental health. But also produce productivity for need, to produce for people's needs, genuine needs, the needs of the community, and people feel engaging that they're producing for the needs of the community rather than producing for the need of business or a multinational.
Finally, to go back to where we started, what might the welfare state look like under post-capitalism, do you think?
In some ways, I see it being not too dissimilar to what we have in terms of perhaps structurally. And I say that in terms of say that the services available, so on that sort of practical basis, in terms of the services available, we will still have the need for a health service. Now, in a post-capitalist world, the hope is that a health service will be more preventative, one that's more reactionary in terms of focusing on symptoms. But we would still have, say, as we have in Britain, a national health service, but one which is hopefully more preventative in nature. In a post-capitalist world, I still see the need for social security. I still see the need for supporting people through monetary means who are unable to support themselves, whether they be unemployed individuals or whether they be simply individuals who just cannot work for various reasons or another. Added to that, we could see a welfare state in a post-capitalist world as being one where things like a basic income or a core income is a central feature of that. So in one way, I see the welfare state that we have already as still featuring in a post-capitalist world. It's the relations within it, which I think would be very different within an alternative society. It's rather than it being a very much a hierarchical organization, rather it being something which is very much one where individuals feel regulated, a welfare state would be one in which cooperation and altruism would be an essential aspect of it. It would be one whereby the recipients of a service would also be the providers of that service. And so based on that, I see the welfare state as not being certainly as distant as it is. It would be one which is very much embedded within localities, one which is very much embedded in communities. We could argue that we may see a far stronger role, an expansive role for local government in the delivery of health services, of social security services. It would be a welfare state whereby the community is involved in provision and delivery of services, where recipients have a democratic voice in the provision of those services. But it would be also a service which has a strong role in promoting certain morals within society. Now, our current welfare state, if we identify various sorts of values and morals, we could argue that the welfare state under capitalism, especially if we look at the social security system, has a very strong role in promoting the work ethic. Now, the welfare state under an alternative system would still play a very strong role in promoting morals, but it would be morals of, say, altruism, for example, in terms of welfare services would be there to encourage you to help other people and then trying to instill those morals within the wider society. Having services devolved very much to the local community level would help to promote the morals of collectivism, in terms of where you as an individual can see how your input to these services is helping to create and develop and promote these services, and seeing that other individuals are benefiting from your input, whether it be through your engagement in the delivery of that process, or whether it be simply through your financial contributions to those services. I mean, again, this is something which is really much, when it comes to me, sort of like work in process in terms of my thinking. But I see the welfare state in a post-capitalist society as, in many ways, as I say, having the same services, but I see the relations, like I said, as being very different there. Rather than living in a society where we produce goods, the welfare state in a post-capitalist society will have a strong role in producing fulfilled individuals and individuals with hopefully optimal well-being. So it's about social reproduction, the reproduction of individuals and producing individuals, but individuals who are fulfilled and non-alienated individuals there. That's broadly how I see.
David, it was great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Very much. Thank you for inviting me.
That's it for this episode. More details about David Matthews and the topics we discussed can be found on the relevant episode page at postcapitalismpodcast.com. Our music is by Chocolat Billy. More information about them is also available on our website. And if you want to get in touch, you can reach us at info@postcapitalismpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.